This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week we come to you from
Paris
in an amazing hotel that just reopened after many, many years of renovation and restoration. The Hotel Lutetia, which is truly the only luxury hotel on the Left Bank right here in Paris. If truth be told, I'm definitely a shopaholic, especially here in Paris, where there are so many great opportunities to, I'm not talking about new clothing or new design or new furniture. I'm talking about antiques. I'm talking about history. I'm talking about flea markets. In fact, he's known as Mr. Flea Market here in Paris, Riyad Khanif. Is it Khanif or Khanif?
Knife.
It's Khanif. And the last time we talked, if truth be told, I went to the flea market and took some of your suggestions, and I found the most amazing piece, which I now have in my house. And it has great meaning to me because of what I do for a living as a journalist. I found, by the way, getting it back in the suitcase was not easy, okay?
That's great.
It was a wrought iron, very, very heavy metal sign, and the sign itself, that was just the wrought iron holder of the sign. The sign itself was basically a very heavy porcelain enamel painting with an arrow pointing to the hotel concierge from a hotel from the turn of the last century. And I figured, what perfect thing should I have in my house than that, right, in the travel industry? But there's not just one flea market in Paris.
In fact, bonjour, Peter, and welcome to Paris.
Yes.
So we call the market a flea market, but in fact it's an antiques market. And it's important to say to people that flea market in USA, it's a garage sales. So most of my customers, when they come to Paris and they discover the antiques market, which is the marché opus in French, which is a translation in English, flea market, they said, Riyad, it's not a flea market, it's an antiques market.
It is.
Yes. And the market, we have two markets. We have the one which is the north of Paris. If you see Paris as a clock, it's exactly at 12. It's one building out of Paris, just after the Ring Road, at Porte de Clignancourt. So the market is spread in two parts, one for the clothing, you know, and sports shoes and, you know, stuff like
right.
that. And the other one, which is the antiques, which existing since 1885. So it's the same location as the beginning.
And is it open every day?
It's open only the weekend, on yeah. Saturday, Sunday, and Monday afternoon. Saturday and Sunday, 10 to 6. And Monday, let's say 12 to 4. Make sure to have all these shops open.
And make sure you get there early.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The key is very simple. If you want to buy, you have to start really at the beginning, because most of the professional buyers could be interior designer, dealers, or individual people.
And the good stuff gets snapped up right away.
Exactly. You don't see, because as soon as they sell something, they take out from the shop and they replace in a minute.
Now, I know some of this is changing, but for those Americans who think that you can buy everything on a credit card, think again. Only about half that of the stalls will take a credit card.
Most, let's say 90% of the shops today, say, take credit cards. It's better to pay by MasterCard or Visa card, because Amex, you know, they take...
The commission.
Yeah,
well, I've always
thought, commission.
Listen, someone from America is going to hate me when I say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. The best way to get a discount at a flea market is to use your credit cards without ever using them. And what I mean by this is this. You go to a store or a stall, you negotiate the best price you can, and then you whip out an American Express card, and they go, no, too expensive. And you say, okay, how much will you give me a discount for Visa? And the price comes down. And then you go, okay, how much will you give me as a discount for cash? So you whip out the plastic, never intending to use it.
Yes.
And you use that as a negotiating tool to come down in price. And it works almost every time.
Yes, you know, and only a few shops take American Express. Most of them take Visa and MasterCard.
Right, and yeah. most of them don't want to take it.
And if you pay one part in cash, you know, because in the antiques culture, when they buy something from a shop, they pay one part in cash, one part in credit card or check, you know?
Why?
So maybe because this is the culture of antiques. People used to pay one part in cash, one part in official by check.
And I carry more than one Visa card for another reason. One of my Visa cards, which I use almost entirely in the U.S., I found out the hard way, carries with it a foreign transaction fee. The other one has no transaction fee. That's what I use to buy anything outside the U.S. because it's a sticker shock when you come back and find anywhere from 1% to 3% of what you paid for being charged to you for a foreign transaction fee. So there are ways to get around it. But the most important thing is get there early.
Yes, yes. At the opening.
What's the most amazing find that you've had at one of the flea markets?
I was hunting on the market a few years ago for a client. When you say
a client, they're giving you a specific mandate or assignment, Riyad.
It depends. In fact, most of them just bought a house or an apartment,
and they want you to help furnish it.
Yes, and they want furniture. They want French antiques, and they don't know about the period, the style.
Do they go with you, or you just do it for them?
No. I go. No, they go with me.
Oh, good. Good.
They go with me. We have a nice lunch at Macocotte, the famous restaurant designed by Philip Stark. It's an iconic restaurant today at the flea market. And we were hunting antiques, a dining table with plus chairs for a client. And I found a piece like a bedside tables in plaster. It was like a piece of art. And I said to the dealer, what is this piece? And the guy said, we don't know. I just hunted this piece. and it's interesting, but we didn't find any information on the piece. So I said to my client, you should buy this piece. So the guy said, I don't need this piece. I said, I know, but this piece, it's a one of the kind. I advise you to buy the piece. The guy said, I insisted, okay. And I said to my clients, if I don't find anything, I will give you back the money. He said, okay, fine. We bet, we do it. So the guy bought the piece. And in fact, I did the research with Sotheby's and Christie's for 2 years. And in fact, I found at the flea market, the antiques market, a museum piece. What is it? It's a bedside table in plaster, okay?
Oh, yeah.
Which represents, in fact, the real bedside table with bronze, top marble, and inlay marquetry. But in fact, this piece was done at the end of the 19th century. It was done for a king or queen who wanted to decide what kind of pattern she would like to get on the bedroom and the bedside tables. So because of a French expert called Christopher Payne, who was the expert and number one expert in cabinet maker from the end of the 19th century, and in fact he expertized the piece, and he said, Riyad, where did you get this piece? I said, from the flea market. He said, I cannot believe you. You know what you have? I said, no. You have a museum piece. I said, what do you mean? He said, we have only 4 copies in the world.
Wow.
And you have one for your customer. It's fantastic. So we are going to exhibit the piece at the antiques market. And this piece is in the book, the new book released by Christopher Payne about the cabinet maker.
Amazing.
So this piece, my client paid a few thousand euro on the piece. And then a few months later, Le Musée des Arts Décoratifs of Paris they wanted to buy the piece. So of course my client refused, and we found the story of the piece. So my client is very happy.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
We know about the Louvre, we know about the Musée d'Orsay, we know about a number of different museums, but here's one that most of you don't know about when you visit Paris, and you should. It's the Musée d'Art et Métiers.
Exactly.
Which is run by our good friend here, the director, Yves Van Kahn. How are you, sir?
Well,
now,
thank you for inviting me, Peter.
What métier means?
Oh, métier means something like technique. It's actually an expression of the 18th century. Arts et métiers was one single expression, which is directly from the encyclopedia. You know, all those French philosophers at the end of the 18th century, they wanted to lay out all practical knowledges, and they were hitting at engineers and artisans. That they wanted to put in writing everything that was known in terms of techniques. And now the revolution in 1794 decided to have a museum devoted to those techniques, so to new machines. And strangely enough, it is a priest, the Abbé Grégoire, who suggested the revolutionaries to create a new museum, which would be some kind of a training ground for the industrial revolution that he was thinking. He thought that it was coming, and he wanted artisans to be ready for the next revolution.
Well, this actually now, hundreds of years later, is the actual repository of one of the oldest collections of technical and scientific apparatus in the world.
I know. We were the first such museum in the world, and many other museums were modeled after us years later. So there was the Louvre for paintings, there was the Museum of Natural History for animals and plants, and Harryware for machines. And we were mainly a prospective museum. We wanted to train for the future. Now, 200 and so many years later, we are more like any other museum, a retrospective museum. We have 80,000 objects.
Did you say 80,000?
80,000. Most of them are in our storage rooms outside of Paris, but we have 3,000 on permanent display here in downtown Paris.
Give me an idea. We talk about machines. Give me an idea of something that's going to surprise people when they come to see it.
Well, you're going to have, of course, steam machines. Sure enough, they were the heart of the new industrial revolution of the 19th century. But you're also going to have the first plane that ever tried to fly. I said tried.
I knew you said
right? It looked like a bat. It had a steam engine in front. You had
a lot of steam-powered planes, I might add.
Yeah, it was a steam-powered plane. That was the first and the last. We are at the turn of the century, and they didn't know exactly how to go about planes. You know, for many years, there was a debate between those who thought that only engines lighter than air would go off, that is, balloons. And there are a few crazy people who thought that, no, engines heavier than air could actually fly. But they didn't know exactly how to proceed.
So let me ask a silly question. If this is the first and last steam-powered plane, I'm assuming somebody tried to fly it.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh,
did
yeah.
a crash.
Yeah, Clément Ader tried. And he, actually, the tiny little wheels did not crush the grass for about 300 meters. And then the plane crashed. But he actually built 3 models, but he was under military contract. So the first 2 models were just burned by the army as military secret. And luckily enough, we kept the 3rd, which is almost flying in our majestic hallway.
But in reality, it never did fly.
It did fly a little bit. You know, it just sort of jumped, you know.
So sort of like the Howard Hughes Spruce Goose. It flew a little bit, and that was it.
Yeah. But, you know, there was a competition at the time with the Wright brothers in the United States. You know, who was going to be the first to really fly? And the French say, of course, it is Adair. And the American, of course, say it is the Wright brothers. That's one example. You know.
That's a big enough one.
Yeah, and we have plenty.
Now, you're open every day or no?
We are open every day, but Monday, as many museums in Paris.
Admission?
Admission, yes, but there are several categories, like children, like young people, who don't pay. Every first Sunday of the month is free. On Thursday night is open until 9:30, so you have the museum for yourself. And I would say entrance around 758 euros.
very reasonable. And if I show up as a steam-powered visitor, do I get in for free?
Oh, yeah, sure. But be careful. You might be put in a case, right? And with a little label.
Well, listen, I'm a big fan of process rather than just product. And as long as I can understand the process, that's when I value the product. So every item in your museum really tells a story, doesn't it? It tells the story of what was tried, what was work, what the technology was like at the time, and how that led to the technology that we that we enjoy today.
Very often what we do is to try to have a series. So we the explanation is within the evolution of the engine. You see one step after the other, and at some point you see the breakthrough when the invention is being stabilized and becomes an industrial innovation.
If you are continuing on to another Southwest destination, please make sure that you check the monitors inside the terminal for your proper gate and flight information. If you are continuing on with another airline, we really don't care.
My next guest, a Boston native, but calls Paris her home. She's the food writer and founder of something called Chow Down. Nice to see you again, Catherine Down.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I mean, you're still in Paris.
Still in Paris.
Still writing about it.
Still writing about it.
And let's talk about this, because I have never been, and I know this is going to sound almost unbelievable, I've never been disappointed in the food scene here, ever. It's like I can't find a bad restaurant.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that. There are bad restaurants. They do exist.
I'm sure they do.
That's why I have a job, is because I help people navigate the overwhelming food scene in Paris and figure out where's the best place to spend their time and their money when they're here. But we are overall extraordinarily lucky with the quality of the products that we have and the French dedication to, you know, gastronomy.
And of course, in that common definitional argument between style and substance, in the style department, you don't go wrong at all. I can't figure out an outdoor cafe that I wouldn't sit at.
Yes, well, and this is a particularly nice time of year to be here for that. There's a real culture of the flâneur in Paris, which is the person who strolls and walks through the city. And so a lot of the cafes, the tables are oriented with everyone seated towards the sidewalk.
It's people watching on steroids.
Exactly. And it's culturally encouraged, and you are supposed to linger. You know, you can kind of spend as much time on the terrace as you want, which is wonderful.
Although, I'll give you a lesson that I learned in Italy. You tell me if it also applies here in France. When you sit down at one of these cafes, obviously there's a menu, but if they bring you bread,
yeah,
you're charged for that.
No, that's more in Italy than it is in France.
Yeah.
And in Italy, it's coperto, and there'll usually be a charge on the menu. In France, it's not the same, but they also don't tend to bring bread before the meal. They bring it alongside your main course. We have extraordinary butter here, but they don't actually serve bread and butter together. It's usually just sort of meant to sop up sauces, and so you don't fill up on the bread basket at the beginning of the meal the way that I tend to do when I'm back in the States.
Now, this hotel has a particularly dangerous location because it's basically a half a block from Bon Marché.
Yes.
And for those people who've never been to Bon Marché, you are warned, you are cautioned, you're going to go nuts in there.
It is pretty extraordinary.
I walk in there, and it's on three or four different levels. I mean, you can go to the houseware section if you want. I tend to stay in the food section.
Yeah.
You walk in, I mean, just the cheese section alone.
Oh, it is fantastic. And it's a really good one for this time of year because a lot of cheese shops are closing for the summer holidays and people will go away for 2 to 6 weeks. And so a lot of the cheese shops right now, their selection is actually dwindling. But someplace like the Bon Marché that's going to stay open all summer, you can go there and know that you're going to have an incredible selection.
Now, I may be different than other people. In fact, I know I'm different than other people when it comes to this. I'm a huge fan of the stinkier, the creamier cheese is the one I like.
Well, you're in the right country.
And they've got the stinky cheeses in there.
Oh, yes, definitely.
They've got one that I can't even find in the States anymore called Saint Marzelin.
Okay, yes.
And it comes in its own little ceramic dish, which you get to keep after you buy it.
Oh, yes.
But if you're going to get that cheese, make sure the people you're with understand what you're eating, because the smell is unbelievable, but it's the most amazing cheese.
The bark is worse than the bite, too. It always smells a lot stronger than it actually tastes. And that one, because it comes in a little ceramic dish, you can actually pop it in the oven with a little drizzle of honey on top. And I find that it helps people get over the smell.
It's amazing cheese. But of course, the politically incorrect statement of the foie gras section of Bon Marché is also pretty intimidating.
Yes. Oh, definitely. I think it can be a little overwhelming to walk up to, you know, some of the displays there because they're so beautifully done. And but they have an extraordinary selection. They work with incredible producers.
And then last but not least, for me, the favorite is to go to the seafood display because it's not just the seafood, it's the shellfish. They bring in all the oysters from Normandy, still in the boxes.
Yes.
That they came off the boats. It's unreal.
It really is.
But forgetting just going shopping at Bon Marché,
yes,
which you can do easily from Lutetia, which is why it's so dangerous, you've got so many other places in town that I like to go to. I mean, I have my shopping list, you know. There's the macaroons, but I don't go to La Durée. I go to Paramé.
That's the best.
See, I go to Fauchon because they make the most incredible cheese-filled crackers.
Oh, wonderful. I haven't had those yet.
Ah, you're missing out.
Thank you for the tip.
Yes, and I have to tell you this. I am a pescatarian. Mm-hmm. I haven't had meat in 10 years, except once a year I make an exception, and that's here in Paris. I go to a restaurant called Le Hide,
okay.
H-I-D-E.
Okay.
So about a block and a half off the Champs-Élysées, with an Asian chef, an amazing French-Asian fusion menu.
Excellent.
And he makes the most amazing pan-fried foie gras.
Well, if you're going to, you know, break your pescatarianism, that sounds like the right way to do
it.
I'm
telling you, I go down in flames. It's amazing. But let's talk about your hits now.
Yeah.
What's the new stuff on your list?
Oh, there's so many right now. The one that I am particularly enamored with in this moment is called Cravin. It's out in the 16th arrondissement, and it's a team from Fragments, which is a wonderful coffee shop in the Marais, and one of the co-founders of Le Chateaubriand, which is consistently on the world's 50 best restaurant list. And so they felt like, okay, there's nowhere that I can go where I can have cocktails all day, where I can have coffee all day. And so they're open from 8 to 11, 7 days a week, which is incredibly rare in Paris. And they have just flawless, perfect little bites, like a beautiful croque madame. They have incredible hot dogs, which I know sounds strange telling
hot
an American to come to
Paris
and eat a hot dog, but it is wrapped in brioche with an onion compote.
So basically the hot dog is basically coincidental to a fabulous brioche.
No, exactly. It's all about the bun on that one. And then it's a beautiful bar from 1911. So it's got the faience. It's got the wonderful tiles from 1911, the zinc bar. It has a nice terrace. And so you go there, and it's the cafe that you imagine going to in Paris, except the food is just completely flawless. You have incredible cocktails and really good coffee all day long.
Now, I'm still a fan of Brasserie Lip.
Okay, yeah.
Only because it's like so traditional
yeah.
of the original brasserie where the waiters have been there for 50 years and they don't really care about what you want. They're going to tell you what you should order.
No, I mean, I think the attitude in a lot of French restaurants is not that the customer is always right. The customer is frequently wrong, and you are there and the chef is the expert and they're an artist, and so you are spending your money for their, you know, artistry. It's a very different attitude than in the States.
Now, my favorite bookstore is located conveniently next to that place. It's the Galliano's bookstore,
mm-hmm.
right next to the Hotel Maurice. And on the other side is Angelina.
Yes, the very famous Angelina.
I mean, this is not just hot chocolate. This is a nap waiting to happen.
Yes. Oh, instantly head on the table.
I'm telling you, how rich is it?
It's incredible. It's very thick. It's very dark. It's not too sweet. It is wonderful. But I have to say, I actually have one that I prefer over Angelina.
I'm opening the door here.
Angelina has the history, but for me, it's Jacques Chenin all the way, G-E-N-I-N. He is in the Marais. He has a Salon d'Été
the
there.
Marais.
The Marais is a neighborhood, you know, right along the Seine. It's the third and fourth arrondissement. And when he first opened up there, not a lot of other chocolatiers of his level had opened in that neighborhood. They're all in the Saint-Germain area because this is where, you know, the neighborhood is more associated with luxury now. And in the Marais, it was a little bit edgy for him to open up at the time. And now all these other shops.
Because it wasn't such a hot neighborhood.
Wasn't such a hot neighborhood. And so it's really gentrified as his shop has been there. And now these other chocolatiers are opening up shops in that area following suite. So Pierre Hermé has opened up a macaron shop. Patrick Roger has opened up a chocolate shop. But Jacques Chenin was sort of the leader in that neighborhood. And he has an extraordinary hot chocolate.
Okay, can I ask a stupid question? What makes it an extraordinary hot chocolate?
Just the quality of the chocolate, the cream, the experience. In Paris, a lot of restaurants will sort of jam tables all together. You kind of have your knees up to your chin. And there, the tables are incredibly far apart. They have
sort of the Alain Ducasse version of hot chocolate.
Exactly. It looks like a temple or a museum for chocolate. Whenever I walk past it, it looks like a shop that should be selling luxury handbags. It doesn't look like a chocolate shop that I've ever seen before. And so it's a real sense of luxury when you're there. They put on white gloves whenever they're putting together boxes of chocolate. So they have these 144-piece boxes of chocolates, and they will put on white gloves and
let
you pick out each one.
And by the way, Catherine knows it's 144 pieces because she counted every one.
I have no restraint when it comes to that place. I could eat the entire, you know, box by myself. But he makes my favorite favorite hot chocolate, and you can order a whole side bowl of whipped cream. But he also does a choco
entire side bowl,
a side bowl of whipped cream that has Tahitian vanilla in it. You can see the flecks.
This isn't a nap waiting to happen. This is a deep sleep.
Oh, absolutely! But it is well worth it. And he does a choco chino as well, which is his version of a mocha. That's very decadent, and that's the lighter option, the diet option compared to the hot chocolate.
So. All right, now here's a stupid question for you, but it's a touristic question.
Yeah.
When was the last time you took a bateau mouche?
Probably 4 years ago. But it's not a bad way to get to know the city. For the first time, because a lot of the major monuments and museums are clustered along the water, so it is a nice way to sort of get oriented. We don't have much air conditioning here, so having a bit of a breeze as you're on the water is a nice thing as well.
Yeah, I have an admission to make. Recently in London, I've been going to London since I'm 12 years old. Mm-hmm. Recently in London, I did something I never thought I'd ever do because I'm an elitist. I got on the hop-on, hop-off tour bus.
And what did you think?
And I put the headphone. I loved it.
Excellent.
I mean, you know, for somebody who thinks she knows everything, I didn't know half of that stuff. And I really learned. I would like to do that here in Paris.
Oh, good.
You can do it.
I've never done one, actually.
I did a bateau mouche, and it's great. The one to really do is if you're in Berlin on the river there. Okay. Then you really see stuff.
Excellent.
But here, if you've never done it, do it once. And I'm one of those guys that do it during the daytime.
Yeah.
And the only reason is at night, it's better to walk around and have your moments in the night with the Eiffel Tower lit up and everything else.
Yeah.
Because of all the monuments in Paris, that's the only one that I know that is truly blazing at night.
Yeah, and for the first 5 minutes of every hour, it'll glitter as well. And so it's nice when you can see it at the very beginning of the hour.
All right, so we've dealt with hot chocolate. We've dealt with my addiction, my once-a-year addiction to foie gras. But what's your new special one? In terms of a food experience here in Paris?
The ones that I'm most excited about right now, there's a couple of restaurants that are doing French-Asian fusion in a really interesting way.
That's like Lihida, yeah.
Exactly, like the place you love. There's one in the 11th called Le Rigmarole. And
I love the name.
It's a great name, and you can do a tasting menu or you can order a la carte. And they are working with a Japanese grill, and they're doing all different interesting kinds of skewers of really unusual cuts of meat that you don't often see. So it's for more adventurous eaters. And the pastry chef comes from 3 Michelin star background. So you're getting, you know, 3 Michelin star quality pastries in a neighborhood restaurant.
By the way, that's 3 Michelin star quality butter.
Yes, exactly.
And more butter. And while
butter
you're at
and
it,
cream.
More butter.
But I also love, there's a new place called CAM, C-A-M. And it's a real restaurant industry favorite. It's a Korean chef, but he is doing really interesting Japanese, Korean, and French food all mixed together. They focus on natural wines, which is quite trendy in Paris right now. Those are wines that use as little sulfites or stabilizers as possible. The idea is that the fruit is supposed to shine. But for people who are more into traditional wine, it can be an interesting experience because they can be a little cloudy or a little fizzy in ways that you would not expect a lot of wines to be. And it's really good people watching. It's a fashion industry hangout. So if you just go and you sit there, you know, it's just incredible to stare around the room and see the famous chefs who show up on their nights off and to see the fashion industry people. So it's a lot of fun for people watching and eating.
Well, one of the great concept books that have come out in the last couple of years, of course, is Where the Chefs Go to Eat.
Yes.
Right? So where do the chefs go to eat in Paris?
They're going to CAM right now. They're going to Yard Wine Bar, which has been around for several years, but it just reopened recently under a new partnership from a wine distributor and a website called Culinaries. And they have a beautiful terrace. It's near Père Lachaise Cemetery. And that is where you'll see all the chefs on their night off. They're eating.
Of course, Père Lachaise Cemetery is where, guess who's buried?
Oscar Wilde, Edith Piaf.
And?
Jim Morrison.
There you go, from the Doors.
All the best dead people are at Père Lachaise. So if you go to the cemetery, you can go to Yard for lunch, or the wine bar opens up at 6 p.m. And they're doing smoked langoustine tails that have been smoked over hay. It's a chef who used to be at Vivant, which is a great wine bar. He used to be at Sauterne and a number of other really fantastic restaurants in Paris. And he's just doing some unusual stuff at the wine bar there.
Okay, the one meal we really haven't talked about is breakfast.
Yes.
So enlighten me as to your hot pick for breakfast here in Paris right now.
My hot pick for breakfast right now. Well, breakfast here tends to be pretty light and sweet. The French love pastries in the morning.
I haven't noticed that.
Yeah, shocking.
Lie.
They do, you know, bread and butter. They do yogurt. But it's not sort of salty, savory things like sausage or eggs like we are used to. So that more Anglophone style brunch can be hard to find. I do love a cafe called Muscovado, which is in the 11th, and it's two sisters from the Philippines, and she was a pastry chef in training, and she has some really wonderful pastries, but then she does a more Anglophone style brunch. She'll do different egg dishes. She'll do avocado toast, things like that. So if you want a heartier brunch, Muscovado is a great place.
The French are big on avocado toast these days.
They are. It's become very popular, which is shocking because it's really sort of out of their wheelhouse to do something savory like that in the morning.
No, you see it on every breakfast menu. How would you like your eggs with avocado toast?
No, exactly.
Right? They butter it with avocado.
And she does a wonderful version there. So I highly recommend going to Muscovado. If you're looking for great pastries, in this neighborhood, you've got Poilaine, which is a bakery that's been around since 1932.
Walking distance to the
hotel. Walking distance to the hotel. And they still have a wood-burning oven, which is quite unusual in Paris because now they're illegal, but they've been grandfathered in because they've been around for so long. Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel, cruising and playing the radio,
with no particular place to go. Audible.com has more than 150,000 titles and virtually every genre. So check it out for yourself. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial. My next guest is a member of a group that I know quite well and that you should know quite well if you travel anywhere around the world. It's Le Clé d'Or, otherwise known as the Golden Keys. You'll see that from on their lapels when they stand behind the concierge desk, and he's the head concierge at the hotel, Lutetia, and his name is Bastien Lalanne. Is it Lalanne?
You can say it Lalanne, yes.
Okay, I did it. Well, thank you for having us. Obviously, you were at another hotel before this one because this hotel was closed for nearly 4 years.
4 years. Yeah. Oh, actually, 4 years and a half.
Wow, longer than I keep on thinking.
Yeah.
Wow. I will share this story with you because I do this all the time. When I was coming to Europe for the first time, I was 12 years old, and I remember walking in with my mother in Cannes into the Carlton. And by the way, it's still designed the same way. There was the hotel reception desk, and there was the hotel concierge desk, two separate and distinct areas. And my mother was terrified of the concierge because they had their own separate bill. It was a separate entity, really.
True.
And the first thing she said to me when we walked into the hotel is, don't ask them anything. She also walked me into the Hotel de Paris in Monte Carlo, or in Monaco, and she took one look at the hotel, and she looked at me, and she said, don't touch anything. But, I mean, we've come a long way from there, and yet we haven't, because if you take a look at the traditional definition of a hotel concierge, you guys are all knowing, you're all connected, and when I say you guys, I'm also talking about women as well.
True.
That you are connected in a global network of concierges so that you can be in touch with any concierge at any other hotel in any other city in the world to be able to make my day better. But yeah, it's not about just you getting me tickets to a movie or a theater or tickets on the Bâton Mouche. It's much more than that.
It is. It is much more than that. And actually, it's indeed a worldwide association. We are now a little bit more than 4,000 members all around the world. And we're indeed able to solve any type of problem of our guests traveling around the world.
At any time of the day or night?
At any time of the day and night, yeah.
I mean, what have been some of your challenges?
So many of them. I remember one in particular that was a few years ago. And we had a traveler coming from the States through London. And, you know, as you go through security, you have to drop all your belongings, and particularly your metal belongings, and you just drop it in a box, and you go through the gate, right, and then you retrieve it after right. the gate. Unfortunately, that person forgot the most important bracelet she had from her family, and she just forgot it in the box, and she's that was the train station. That was the St. Pancras train station.
Oh, of course, she was taking the train.
Huge station, yeah, where you have millions of people every day, and she just forgot it. And she just came to see me at the desk and was crying, and she asked me for assistance.
Well, who do you call?
I called a friend, a Gold Key member in London.
Well, you know what it is? we have to call this what it is. Concierges should pride themselves on a very New York saying. I know a guy. You knew a guy. True.
I know a guy. Yeah. I have a friend.
You had a friend. And you called.
I have a friend in London. And so I asked him if he has any contacts at the train station. And he had contacts at the train station. So then I started calling people at the train station. My contact friend helped me as well getting in touch with the right person, the right service, and have
Please
somebody.
Tell me they found the bracelet.
I won't tell you the end of the story right now. I tell you the process first. So we found people looking around, searching in the station, asking many different people. And at the end, indeed, they found the bracelet. So what we did, my friend sent somebody at the train station to pick up the bracelet and have it delivered on the same day to the guest in Paris.
And by the way, when you do things like that, the guest comes back and stays again.
True.
They remember that connection.
They remember it. They remember it. And that's a great souvenir for all of us.
Yeah. But I mean, I've heard stories of concierges getting calls at 10 o'clock at night from somebody who wanted to charter a 747 the next day. And they found it.
They found it.
I mean, unless it's illegal or immoral, it's about everything you can do, you can do.
Yes, but it has to be legal.
Yes, we
it
know
has
that.
To be legal. It has to be legal, otherwise we don't do it.
But if it's legal and strange, you can do it.
Yes, we can. We can.
I know.
Yeah, it's just.
I mean, I've heard about white lions in hotel guest rooms that somebody wanted a white lion or a white tiger. They found them.
They do. Yeah. And in Cannes, you were talking about Cannes.
Yeah.
A friend of mine got some. Those were like kangaroos for a party by a pool. In a big villa near Cannes during the Cannes Festival.
And let me guess, some of the other guests were hopping mad? No, just okay. I couldn't resist.
Welcome to Alaska Flight 438. We'd like to tell you now about some important safety features of this aircraft. The most important safety feature we have aboard this plane is the flight attendants. Please look at one now.
Most American visitors to France, or to Paris for that matter, they may go to the Louvre or the Musée d'Orsay. They may know about, Notre Dame or some of the neighborhoods. They might even go over to the Eiffel Tower. Ew, what a surprise. But not many of them know that there's an amazing place here in Paris called the American Library in Paris. And what a great history it has, and what a great resource it is. And joining me now, the assistant director at the American Library, Abigail Altman, who, by the way, is from Albany, New York, and came here 20 years ago for love. Not only did she stay, she just celebrated her 16th wedding anniversary with her husband. Abigail, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
You expat, you.
I can't help it. I've lived in Paris longer than any other place in the world now.
And no regrets.
No regrets. I love it here.
And even though you came 20 years ago, when did you get involved with the American Library?
I'm actually in my second stint at the American Library right now. I first worked there about a decade ago. I had been a bookseller and decided to have a career change and become a librarian. And I was hired at the American Library. And I worked there for about 2 years. And then I left and did something else. Worked in a school library. And now I've been back for 5 years.
Wow. Now, people don't really know much about the American Library. You don't see it in the guidebooks. You don't see it mentioned a lot, but it's a fixture here.
It's an absolute fixture. We're about to celebrate our centennial. We were founded in 1920, just after the war, and we're an unbelievable resource for anybody who's interested in the English language, reading in English. The library is a private nonprofit, so everyone who uses the library needs to be a member. But this said, tourists are certainly allowed to come and buy a day pass to come read magazines, read newspapers, use the internet. And of course, we have a very vibrant speaker series during the season, so people can come and listen to authors and journalists, artists, cookbook writers who are speaking at the library in the evenings. Those events are free and open to the public because we have a foundation that sponsors them.
Now, it's one thing to talk about events or reading a magazine or having access to the internet, but you have a rather interesting collection.
We do have an interesting collection. We're the largest English language library on the European continent.
That's a wow right there.
It is a wow, and I think we've been this size for 50 or 70 years. We have 100,000 books and magazines. We have a periodical archive that includes magazines that are found nowhere else in Europe. that researchers come to consult. We have an archive of fashion magazines that many students of fashion come to look through. So we have an eye on what might be hitting the runways in the future, depending on which decades are requested.
Now, as a writer myself, I'm still in love with libraries. I grew up in New York City. My library is still a half a block away from me, New York City Public Library. And yes, I can work at my house, or I can work at my office, but when nobody's looking, I'll literally walk a half a block over to the library where I know no one's going to call me. I can't get on my cell phone. And I can just upstairs sit there and think.
That's absolutely why people come to the American Library to work. We certainly have our share of readers who check out books and come to events, events for kids or events for adults, but the reading room is full every day with people who are studying, people who are researching or writing, people who are working on projects they can't possibly do in a cafe or even a co-working space.
All right, they can't do this at Starbucks.
No, sometimes we say we are in competition with Starbucks for Wi-Fi and comfortable chairs. The library renovated 2 years ago, so we feel like the space now maybe exceeds people's expectations.
And how is the library financially supported?
The library has been private since 1920. We originally started to provide books for American soldiers who were serving in Europe, and books were sent over as early as 1916 and 1917. But in 1920, after the war, there was a collection of English language books in Paris and a library that was very popular with soldiers and civilians after the war. So we had the opportunity to raise the funds and become a private nonprofit, which we have been ever since.
And you've been self-sustaining ever since?
We have been. We don't get any money from the French government. We don't get any U.S. tax dollars. Memberships support about 25% of the operating costs. The rest is fundraising, donations, gifts, and grants, including our annual gala. We just had Salman Rushdie come and speak. We are in our fourth address now over the years. We're in the shadow of the Eiffel Tower, just at the Champ de Mars.
Wow.
On a small street called General Camus, so you need to use your map.
Right, but easily accessible.
Absolutely. Metro, buses, on foot.
All right, so right before the break, I brought up the idea of Ernest Hemingway working on your newsletter. He did.
Ernest Hemingway did write for our newsletter. We had a newsletter in the 1920s called Ex Libris, which we reinstated in the 80s and still is going strong today. I suspect that he was coerced into doing so by Gertrude Stein. Gertrude Stein was a member of the library and a donor and a user of the library. And in one of the editions of Ex Libris, they have dueling book reviews of Sherwood Anderson's biography, A Storyteller's Tale. So they each write their review of this particular book.
And you had so many legendary writers or American expat writers who've gone through your doors.
We have, and I'm constantly finding in the archives traces of other people who have been affiliated with the library over the year. Edith Wharton was an early trustee, Gertrude Stein. We had a relationship with Sylvia Beach. She donated books to us from her lending library at Shakespeare & Company after the Second World War when she wasn't able to reopen. We have a very interesting collection of books that belonged to Marlene Dietrich, and I brought one to show you. I'm very sorry we're on the radio and no one else can see it.
Well, I can see it.
Henry Miller, Julia Child, Colette, Ford Maddox Ford, Richard Wright. It's a very long list of people who have passed through the library's doors, and it continues to today. We have authors who are well-known and aspiring who come and use our space and who speak at our evening events.
Great. Okay, tell me about the books you brought.
I brought two books to show you. One is from Sylvia Beach's lending library that she donated to the library, to our library in 1951. So you can see it has her book plate and then our book plate in it.
I see. Shakespeare Company, absolutely.
And the second book I brought is from the donation we received from the Marlene Dietrich estate. After she died, we received books from her grandson, which were in English, many of which were biographies, which she had annotated in red and black felt-tip pen with the words "not true" all over them.
You're kidding.
No.
Biographies of her?
Yes, biographies of Marlene, where she has annotated herself. This page says, "Everything is not true." So a little bit of revisionist history.
Actually, Schitt said, "Everything is not true, and I want to be alone."
Mm.
Right? And she was for quite some time. Interesting stuff.
Yeah, I believe she was housebound in Paris at the end of her life.
Wow. And yet now you're open every day?
We're open 6 days a week. We're actually closed to the public on Mondays, but
like,
we're open.
Like the museums?
Like the museums. We need a chance to be able to put the books back on the shelves and take a breather. In the summer, we do have reduced hours, so if people are visiting us during the summer season, they should check the website.
And the website is?
AmericanLibraryInParis.org.
By the way, the history of how the library started, I think, is fascinating. About the soldier who died?
When we had the opportunity to transform the collection of books that had been sent over to U.S. soldiers into a private library, we were able to do so only if we raised enough funds to become an independent institution. And the major donor who stepped up in 1920 was Charles Seeger. His son, Alan Seeger, was a poet who died for France. He had joined the French Foreign Legion even before the U.S. joined the war. He died in battle, I believe, in 1916. And the library was founded in part to commemorate his sacrifice and to memorialize Americans who fought for France.
And you had your own lending library. You were sending books to the soldiers when they were in the hospitals.
Absolutely. We sent books to training camps, to hospitals. In the Second World War, we resumed the practice as well. At that point, we were working with the American Library Association in order to send the books out. Our original location, which is on Rue de l'Elysée, it's now part of the Presidential Palace, so unfortunately you can't visit it anymore. But we are sharing the space with the YMCA and the Red Cross and using their vehicles, I think, to get the books out to the training camps.
When somebody visits the library, what's the biggest surprise they're not expecting?
A very friendly sense of American customer service. I think that's the thing that makes people happiest when they come in.
Is there customer service in America?
Absolutely. We're known for that.
No, I said in America.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have many non-Americans who are very pleased with the friendly welcome they get, and many expatriates who need a dose of friendly welcome
And are you a lending library?
Absolutely. Members are allowed to borrow the books. The only books that don't circulate are the ones in the special collection, like the Marlene Dietrich book I just showed you.
I love it. Everything in here is not true.
Right. Our most popular section is the kids department
and the teen department. You just gave me an idea.
Yes?
We should go to famous people around the world, show them the biographies about them, and ask them to annotate them, right? And then come out with an edition annotated by them.
I think that would be quite popular.
And I have a great an imprint. We'll just call it Revisionist History.
Perfect. We'll stock that in the library.
Next year in the Revisionist History edition of, right? Why not?
Sounds like a great idea.
The wagon is too slow. Can't you ride?
It's not that he can't ride. How is it you put it home?
They're dangerous at both ends and crafty in the middle. Why would I want anything with a mind of its own bobbing about between my legs?
My next guest, an American journalist, she writes for Afar, Condé Nast Traveler, but most importantly, she's the author of a book called The New Paris, which was published last year by Abrams, and her name is Lindsay Tremuda. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
A Philly girl.
Yes, indeed.
What brought you to Paris?
Studies.
12 years ago,
I was studying French literature and linguistics, and I knew that eventually I'd need to come to Paris or somewhere in France to actually put those skills into practice.
No, to justify your education.
That too. I think my parents would be happy knowing that I actually made that next step. But that ended up changing my life. A short trip ended up changing everything. And so I found a way to come back and then stay and never leave.
You know, you talk about a new Paris. I first came here when I was 12 years old with my parents and my younger sister. And I was always told, oh, the Parisians are aloof and they're rude. Since I'm 12 years old, I've never had that experience.
No.
I fall in love with this place more and more, not less and less. And yet you came out with a book called The New Paris.
Right.
In what way is it new?
It was really an attempt to say that all of the things that make it special and magical and that has been romanticized for generations is not the whole story. That actually there's this other super progressive side of Paris, a Paris that's actually looking forward and looking to change and adapt with the changing world and isn't hemmed in by its past. There's this thought that Paris is very much a place, it's a living museum city. We've heard that time and time again, but in fact, there's so much more going on. And this book was a way for me to show exactly in what ways that's happening.
What would it be safe to say it's still a living museum city? We're not going to argue that point, but is it a living museum city? city that allows all the new stuff to happen.
In a way, I mean, I think that it wouldn't continue to attract the people even to its new elements if it weren't for the old. I mean, I think that's indisputable. It would always be an attraction.
Okay, so let's talk about the failed art history majors that still think they have to go to the Louvre once before they die. I got it, because they've got to see that little bitty painting called the Mona Lisa. I got it. That's inevitable. You're still going to have those visitors, but now they get a chance to do something else.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that's developed even within the city in terms of urban development. I mean, if you look at the section between the Musée d'Orsay, another museum that everyone should visit, and the
Alma. But you know what I love about the Musée d'Orsay?
What?
It's not just the exhibits, it's the light.
Oh, the light and the space itself is magnificent.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to be said for a former train station, because that was all about the light as well.
Exactly.
And they kept that.
And it absolutely, I mean, I could talk about how the exhibits themselves are, you know, try to be progressive, but really, I mean, just outside the Musée d'Orsay doors are a few steps that lead down to the riverbanks that used to be open to cars, and now that space, it's about 1.5 kilometers along the riverbanks, are completely reserved for pedestrians. And
it's all walkable.
It's all walkable. They have activities for kids, bars, cafes. People are exercising outside. I mean, that is a way that the city gave back to its population.
We're talking with Lindsay Tramuta, the author of The New Paris. Other than some pedestrian walkways being open,
right,
what would you say is the biggest cutting-edge development that you've seen?
Well, we could talk about how the city has become a major tech hub, an innovative
which
hub,
expect.
Which you wouldn't expect. But in fact, it's outclassed Berlin, which was previously sort of the emerging star in tech and startup life. And, you know, with Brexit, people are being encouraged to come and set up their businesses in France versus London. So that puts Paris on a map in a way that it never was visible before. And then you have just all this foreign talent that's flocking to Paris. So whether that's in the arts, in fashion, or in food, which is obviously the biggest, one of the biggest magnets to Paris, that outward energy, that openness to foreign influence, I think, is one of the biggest things that has changed in the last 10 years.
Wow. And how has it changed you?
Well, I don't think I ever need to live anywhere else. I think Paris is, it tackles everything that I would want in a city. It has its ills, it has its, you know, exciting moments, it has change, and it's always beautiful, even in the spots that aren't traditionally beautiful.
Now, as an American living in Paris, let me ask the obvious question, because Paris in the last 3 or 4 years has certainly had its share of incidents.
Yeah.
That scare a lot of people from coming here. It doesn't scare me. I understand, and I'm not being cavalier about it. I'm just trying to be practical about it. Your friends back in the States, do they think you're crazy?
You know what? No, I think there was a moment of obvious concern, and that was understandable. My parents, same thing, they were concerned. But at the same time, it doesn't take long to realize that it's not necessarily traditionally safe anywhere. I mean, even within the United States, there's danger. And I think that's what my closest friends realized, is that whether I'm here or, you know, in a small town in Ohio or, you know, in the middle of Germany in the Black Forest, there's potential for something. And you can't let yourself stop living for that.
You know, when you think about the fact that only 37% of Americans even have a passport, that automatically puts you in the category of being a rebel, because not only do you use your passport, you've chosen to live outside the United States.
This is true. I didn't think of it that way.
Well, most people would say, I couldn't do what you're doing, and yet you seem to manage pretty well.
I think it was a question of feeling already like maybe there was something else out there for me. As much as I love the States, there was always this feeling that I was being pulled in another direction, and it just so happened that came through another culture and another language, and I came at a time when I was already transitioning into, you know, my adult life. I ended up going to grad school here. I got my first job here. So it's...
Can I give you a hint?
Yeah.
You don't ever want to transition into your adult life.
Why would you want to do that? I don't know how I had any control over it, but it happened. And, you know, I think that's a transformative period. And so because that's when I came, which was pure, you know, chance or circumstance, that really set the course for what I was going to do. Had I come later, maybe it would have been more difficult to make this a permanent stay.
Do you see yourself going back to the States to live?
Honestly, no. Which, you know, I say that and my parents are like, yeah, we kind of knew this, but no, I mean,
so you are the rebel.
I don't know that I would use the word rebel. I would just say that...
You're living an unconventional life.
I guess so.
The charge for looking at this pamphlet is $3. The charge for looking at this pamphlet and putting it back quickly is $4. Over the seas and all the grease to anywhere I please.
Joining me now, the general manager of the hotel, Isabelle Bouvier.
Hotel manager, Peter. Pleasure being with you.
And pleasure having you. And thank you for having us. You and I have known each other for a while. You've come up through the ranks of a lot of major luxury hotels. What makes this one different?
You know, nowadays, each luxury hotel in Paris is having a tremendous history to tell.
And a lot of them have been restored. They're coming back, whether it's the Crillon and many of them.
Absolutely. They all have a terrific history. They all have a terrific design. I would say that nowadays what is making a hotel special for our guests, it's not only the level of luxury that the hotel is providing, but also the level of experience and emotions that the hotel is providing.
Well, let's talk about that, because in true storytelling style, we're talking about a hotel where Ernest Hemingway hung out, James Joyce, Samuel Beckett, Picasso, Matisse, Josephine Baker,
César, Ikili, you name it.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
And, you know, you go back to the Woody Allen film Midnight in Paris, you can see that happening right here at this hotel.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of the magic that the hotel is providing to the guests. But as I was saying, I mean, there are always beautiful stories in all of the Palace Hotel in Paris, in Europe, in the world. The thing that we are also providing to the guests is truly the living like a local. All of our guests are having luxury houses and apartments. Therefore, the level of luxury that is provided by the hotel is at least what our guests are expecting. Now, we are much more focusing on providing the experience of Saint-Germain-des-Prés, of the left bank, of what is making this hotel special. And that is truly the experience
What does that mean?
That means walking in the street. That means walking in the real, authentic Paris. That means when you book a room in this hotel, you will also enjoy a tour of Saint-Germain-des-Prés, of the left bank. We have designed three different tours. One really targeting the historical heart of Saint-Germain-des-Prés and telling the story of the Jardin du Luxembourg, the Panthéon, Notre-Dame de Paris, Saint-Sulpice, the Church Saint-Germain, the whole church abbey history of the left bank. The other one really focusing on the food, on the gourmet art of the left bank in Paris as well, going through the pain poilane, the famous poilane bread, where you can go
walking
down...
Walking distance to here.
Absolutely. It's across the corner of the street, the Rue du Cherche Midi, and that's where you go down and you see the heaven and the hoven. So how do you say it?
The oven.
Oven, yeah.
Which could be the heaven, too.
It's a heaven, absolutely, for the gourmet, and that is dated of the 12th century. And that is really what is making the guests of the hotel feeling like living like a local in Paris. And I think that through these emotions, you make even some further deep souvenir of their stay with us. And that's part of the luxury experience, what you can offer to the guests that is maybe not the top monument of Paris, because all of our guests know the Eiffel Tower and the Sacré-Cœur in Montmartre, but they may not know that the hoven of the Pain Poilane is dated 12th century and can be visited through our link with our concierge.
And that's a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
But speaking of history, you've just gone through a almost four-year renovation,
mm-hmm.
or I should say restoration, if you want to look at it that way too,
yes,
of an iconic building that's over 117 years old.
Yes.
It took a long time. I know that every time I've come to Paris, and I sort of got seduced going over to the Bon Marché, as I went by there, I would always see the scaffolding and the construction here, wondering, when are they going to open? When are they going to open? You just did.
Yeah.
Finally.
We belong to a small group of hotels called The Set. Whether it is the Café Royal in London, the Conservatorium in Amsterdam, or the Lutetia in Paris, the goal was really for our group to buy a truly historical property in the heart of the city. And Jean-Michel Villemotte took over the renovations, the restoration of this project, being a very famous architect. And his goals, there were a number of three. First one was to restore the hotel to the beauty of 1910, and that has taken a very long time to restore the gallery, to restore the frescoes that we find under six layers of paintings in the breakfast room.
Did you know they were there?
We kind of knew they were there because we had seen some photographs of the beginning of the 20th century.
You were hoping they were still there.
We were hoping exactly that they were still there. We didn't know precisely, so we had to go through the architect of the Bâtiment de France, who are specialized in anything that is historical in France, and they've made some research, and they find out that there were still the frescoes. So it was 17,000 hours of restoration to get the frescoes back into the what you see today in the Bar Joséphine.
Should there be a rapid change in cabin pressure, oxygen masks will automatically drop from the compartment above your seat, free of charge. And to start the flow of oxygen, pay your flight attendant $75.63. My mother,
God rest her soul. Perhaps I've saved the best for last. He's the executive chef here at the Lutetia, and quite a repertoire he has. Benjamin Brial, how are you, sir?
Very good, thank you.
You've worked in so many different hotels. I mean, the Ritz being one of them.
Yes, exactly. I used to work in Paris in the Ritz, correct? Also in the Four Seasons Georges V as well, yeah.
Yes, and by the way, I will tell you a compliment from me, from the old George V, the Four Seasons. Your lobster sandwich was unbelievable.
Thank you very much.
There used to be, by the way, a great lobster sandwich next door at the Prince de Gaulle, but they took it off the menu.
Yeah.
And you, I mean, that's, I keep you, you did it. I mean, that was the lobster sandwich.
Yeah, no, we, that's a great dish that we was doing, and we are doing it as well here at the Lutetia.
Okay, so without revealing the secrets, what makes a great lobster sandwich?
It's about the quality, of course, of the product. First, the lobster that we are using. We use Brittany lobster, and also it's about the seasoning.
So coming from Brittany?
So, yeah, correct. Yeah.
Everything that's great comes from Brittany. The butter.
Yeah,
butter. The oysters.
Exactly.
Come on, Brittany.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody.
Yeah, beautiful product in France, all over France, but especially that's true in Brittany. We can find a lot of best products, like you mentioned about the cream, the milk, butter, oyster, seafood, langoustine. So it's a lot of beautiful products.
But when you're reopening a hotel like this, you have a certain challenge,
yeah.
And maybe it's also an opportunity to figure out, okay, these are the ovens I want. This is the equipment that I want. This is the way I want to work. This is how I want the kitchen design. Learning from past mistakes and applying those lessons.
Exactly. Exactly. Since the beginning, I arrived on the project. I mean, it was really the link with the owner here. He gave me the opportunity to start with the blank page and to draft everything from the choice of the equipment, the concept of the menu that we are doing, etc., etc.
So are there? I always like to say, okay, what's your wish list? Did you want a pizza oven? Did you want a smoker? What did you put in?
Plenty of equipment, to be honest. We have like a charcoal oven, for example, for the room service. So it's one of the specificities you cannot find in a lot of room service menu, a charcoal grill, so we implement here. After, it's a lot of equipment that you can find somewhere else, but it's really about the design, the way that it is, to make sure that the team on a daily basis, they can work with efficiency. That's the most important.
And speed.
And speed, exactly. The key is the speed, because the guests don't want to wait. So for example, we managed to have all the kitchen on the same floor, right next to the restaurant. This is the key.
So the actual distance between the oven and the table is not
exactly.
Long.
Yeah. Exactly.
So be careful, because the plate's going to really be hot.
Exactly. That's true.
What's the one thing, you just reopened, so maybe it's too soon to tell, but what's the one item that you wanted to put on the menu that you figured, you know what, everybody's going to want this. This is going to be my best dish ever, and it didn't work out. Or what's the one dish that you said, do I really have to put this on the menu? No one's going to want this, and everybody wants it.
Yeah. I will start with the one that we're a bit surprised. Maybe it's very simple things. For the Bar Josephine, we implement a salmon rillette. So it's something.
And the Bar Josephine named after Josephine Baker.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. And this salmon rillette, we was not expecting that it's going to be the buzz. And it's a very simple things that you can.
Okay, tell me about the construction of that dish.
It's a very basic dish. It's something that that at home you cook. So it's salmon rillette. It's a slow-cooked salmon mixed with Philadelphia and some spices, lemon zest, orange zest. So it's very, very basic. But people, they just love it. Come for a drink.
Well, you can't go wrong with salmon.
You spread it on a nice sourdough bread, and that's it. And we was not expected. And we laugh with the team because we're going to call it the Lutetia rillette. It's already the highlight on the menu. It's very simple. It's affordable, but everyone go for it.
Any items on the menu now that date back to the original hotel?
Not really. We completely rephrased the offer. I used to work 7 years in different places, in Shanghai, Hong Kong, London. So we start really again with a completely new concept, something really different.
Which is?
So our concept is a French contemporary food, pairing travel and sharing. This is our concept. So you can find it all over the place in the Lutetia, from the Bar Josephine to the Restaurant Saint-Germain, banquet and room service. This is the link between all the outlets.
So any item you want order, you can share.
Exactly. Every single dish that you, if you come to the Saint-Germain restaurant, every single dish is thought about sharing. So the fish is already separated in two. So the dish, you can have it on your own. The portion is right for one people, but you can also share without cutting in front of everyone. So it's really easy. They contract and people, they love it.
Now, you've lived all over the world.
So, yes, not all over. over the world, but some...
Well, not South America yet, but Eurasia.
Exactly, yeah.
Right? You were over in
Shanghai.
In Shanghai, yeah.
Hong Kong. I moved then to Hong Kong. So it was really interesting. It's 5 years in Asia that you can learn a lot about management. You can learn a lot about people, about product, how to make great things with very little things. Some country like China is very difficult to work because you cannot have all the product.
You can't source it all.
Yeah, exactly.
But here you can.
Here you can, yes.
I mean, you can get anything.
Exactly. Every day.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.